Thank you, Rick. Let me do one item of business. Just in case you forgot, like I did, you might want to quiet your cell phone. I thought of that while Dr. T was singing. It didn't happen, but you might want to take care of that before our speaker comes. I'm just really delighted and proud to be able to introduce Dr. Frank Raymond. He is the dean who hired me at the University of South Carolina about 15 years ago and generously supported me when I was a board member previously. So I got some university support for participating in conventions and board meetings and so on then. And before I introduce you more formally, Frank, I want to mention that your wife, Gail, Dr. Gail Raymond, is also with him tonight. Why don't you stand up, Gail? Okay. That was quick. Frank B. Raymond is Dean Emeritus and Distinguished Professor Emeritus at the College of Social Work, University of South Carolina. He graduated from these parts up the road at Wake Forest University, magna cum laude, with a major in religion. He then received an MSW degree from the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and a PhD in social work from Tulane University. From 1959 to 1965, Dr. Raymond served as pastor of Hillcrest Baptist Church in Danville, Virginia. He subsequently began a ministry in the field of social services. During his social work career, in just a few short years, I counted, he worked in public welfare at the Veterans Administration Hospital, for the Federal Probation Office, the Department of Psychiatry at Tulane Medical School, and the Louisiana Narcotics Rehabilitation Commission. In 1972, he joined the faculty of the College of Social Work at the University of South Carolina and served as the dean of that college from 1980 until his retirement in 2002. I think at the time he was the longest-serving dean on campus, one of the longest-serving deans in social work in the country. But he was doing a few other things meanwhile. He's published 5 books related to administration, technology, and social work education, as well as over 200 book chapters and journal articles in many areas of human services and social work education. Dr. Raymond's been a member of NACSW. He's been on the editorial board. He's been on the board for a member of NASW, CSWE, the National Association of Deans and Directors of Schools of Social Work, and the International Consortium for Social Development. He's held major leadership positions in most of these organizations. So would you join me in welcoming Dr. Raymond? Before I turn him loose, I'm going to say one more thing. We got off to a late start tonight, and I'd like to give him full rein to take his allotted time. Go for it.
Thank you very much, Terry. And thanks to all of you for inviting me. This is quite an honor and a humbling experience, too. It's especially important to me to be at this meeting because of the fact that we are remembering Dr. Alan Keith Lucas during this conference. I had the privilege of having Dr. Keith Lucas as a professor when I was working on my master's degree at Chapel Hill. And I was inspired by him then, and subsequently I have been inspired by his teachings, his writings, and certainly his life example. So it's fitting and proper that he be honored during this meeting, and I'm just very happy to be a part of this meeting. The conference theme is, of course, celebrating our past and shaping our future. And this is a big challenge. It's a big topic to address in a week. And I'm going to take a stab at addressing it in one evening, in 45 minutes. My topic is changes in Christian social work, what's new and what's not. In addressing this topic, however, I do want to mention several caveats first. I am not a historian, I am not a futurist, and I'm certainly not a theologian. However, I do proudly claim to be a Christian and a social work educator. I am long in tooth. I remember some of those prices you were talking about, Rick. And I have lived long enough to have experienced some major changes in the past 50 years or so. And I think that this gives me a vantage point of sorts to reflect back at some of these changes, and then perhaps to look forward in anticipation of where we may be going in future years in Christian social work. So I really have three objectives that I would like to accomplish this evening. First, I would like to look back at some of the major changes that have taken place in the past few decades. Not all of them, but major changes. And to show that they are, how they are interrelated. The second thing I would like to do is to talk about the implications of these changes for social work practice, particularly Christian social work practice, and what these mean for us as we prepare our knowledge, skills, and values to enter into the next decades. And the third thing I would like to do is to identify some realities that have not changed, realities that we can carry with us moving forward. Now, I do not want to be like a minister I heard about recently. It seems that when he was ending his sermon and standing at the door to greet the people, one of the men who was leaving said, "Reverend, I want you to know that your sermon today made me think of the peace and love of God." Well, the minister was quite impressed, and he said, "Well, you know, no one's ever said that to me before. I'm flattered. Could you tell me what you meant?" He said, "Well, first of all, it reminded me of the peace of God because it passed all understanding. And secondly, it reminded me of the love of God because it endured forever." I will not endure forever. I will try to get through my comments, though, and I will try to finish in the fullness of time. So let's look at change. Change is all about us. I don't remember much from the philosophy courses I had at Wake Forest, but I remember a course I had on Greek philosophy, and I remember one philosopher. For some reason, I remember that the central thesis of the philosophy of Heraclitus was that the only thing that does not change is the reality of constant change. I think he was on to something. It seems that everything does change, doesn't it? I know that places change. When I go back to walk the paths around Chapel Hill, it's changed a lot. My hometown of Danville, Virginia has changed a lot. People change. Our children grow up. Our parents get older. We change. We have major changes in our lives, some of which are welcome and some of which are not so welcome. But we change. Society changes. We can look back at some of the major changes in the last few years that we can be proud of. The civil rights movement, the women's rights movement. I'm proud to have the ability to remember those movements that occurred during my lifetime. There is so much talk about change today. You will recall that during his campaign for president, President Obama said that this was his theme: change we can believe in. For the past month, the Republicans have been talking about the need for change. Change is very much on our minds. It's such a part of our lives that there are many jokes about change. I like the light bulb jokes. You know the light bulb jokes about change? Do you know how many clinical social workers it takes to change a light bulb? One. But the light bulb has to want to change. Do you know how many community organizers it takes to change a light bulb? None. The system is what needs changing. Do you know how many social work educators it takes to change a light bulb? It takes a roomful because they have to first discuss all the ramifications of the change. So change is all about us. But I would like to lift up to you this evening four major changes that have occurred. I would call these revolutionary changes because they represent true paradigm shifts in the way we view the world and the way we view reality. The first of these is what I would call technological innovation, or sometimes this is referred to as the technology revolution or the information revolution. It is amazing all that has happened in the way we process information. Just listen to some of the things that have occurred during the past several decades. We have moved from party lines to cell phones to texting to Skype. We have moved from radio to television to online entertainment. During our lifetimes, we have moved from books to web-based information to Kindles and iPads. We've moved from the U.S. Postal Service, thank goodness, to email and listservs. We have moved from road maps at service stations to GPS devices. We transferred from typewriters to word processing on computers. We've moved away from dictionaries and manila folders and file cabinets to store information to massive data storage and immediate online retrieval. We have moved in so many ways to make our life happen faster. Information is available to us instantaneously. It's reported that on July the 4th, 1776, King George wrote in his diary, "Nothing much happened today." It took weeks for him to find out that there was rebellion in the colonies on that date. Now we know almost immediately when anything happens on the other side of the world through CNN or on the internet. Information is immediately available to us. Now, obviously, some of these changes are positive. Some of them are very good. We're committed to our information devices, our computers, our cell phones, our telephones, everything that we have for communicating today. These are all positive things in our life. But there may be a negative side as well. James Gleick, in an important book called Faster, said that there's one quality that characterizes our modern age, and that is acceleration. Acceleration. We have become a quick, reflexed, channel-flipping, fast-forwarding, multitasking people. And this is not without consequences. We have become overstressed from all the input of information. We have ceased to be able to communicate, in some cases, face-to-face. People will not even walk down the hall to see their colleagues. They'll communicate by cell phone or by texting. Honestly, my wife and I sat in a restaurant the other night, right beside of a couple, a young couple. They did not talk the entire evening. They were texting. Now, I don't know if they were texting each other or not, but they were texting. Not only has technology created these kinds of problems, but there are many other problems that have resulted from technology, which I'll talk a little bit more about later. But this revolution, the technology revolution, the information revolution, is also related to another major revolution that has occurred during our lifetimes, and that is globalization, the global revolution. When I was a child, I was mesmerized when missionaries would attend my church and talk about their experiences in these far, strange, exotic lands. I couldn't imagine. I never saw anybody from another culture. I only heard about them through missionaries. The only people I knew were black people and white people. My, how times have changed. Now I'm surrounded by people of every color and hue, race and ethnicity. When I walk across the campus at my university, it's like a meeting of the United Nations. Now I'm able to travel to many of these places that I could only dream about as a child. Now I'm able to interact in real time with colleagues and friends, literally on the other side of the world. So globalization has made us one world. We are totally interconnected. There are some results of this globalization. One of these results is diversity. Every society, practically, has become much more diverse, particularly our country. Some of this diversity that our world has experienced is a result of immigration. Now, not all immigration is voluntary. There are many mass population movements today that occur not by choice, but by force, by necessity. Diversity is good. It exposes us to other people and other ideas. It gives people new opportunities to advance in their lives, and it gives us the opportunity to share knowledge. But on the other hand, diversity seems in many places to have fostered distrust, fear, discrimination, paranoia. Another result of globalization is that we have a global economy. Fareed Zakaria was talking about this in a recent article in Time magazine on November the 1st. He wrote these words: "Technology and globalization are working together at warp speed, creating a powerful new reality." He was talking about the economic reality. Today, we are totally integrated worldwide with the sharing of resources. President Obama has been in several countries this week, in India and Indonesia and South Korea, and one of his major objectives has been to try to develop further trade arrangements. Particularly in India, there's a lot of concern about the fact that trade has been one-sided. Some of these changes have been positive. The free trade that we experience among countries has made things available quickly and readily, cheaply. We can go to Walmart or Kmart and buy something dirt cheap. If it breaks, we throw it away, buy another one. The downside of that, though, is it has made us wasteful. It has made us a throwaway society. As a result of this global economy, there has been major transfer of jobs as well, outsourcing of jobs. Thomas Friedman wrote a book a few years ago, and the title of that book was "The World is Flat." He said that in 1492, Columbus sailed west, and he discovered that the world was round. Friedman said, on the other hand, that he flew east, and he discovered that the world is flat. That is to say, we're all connected, economically and otherwise. We interact economically with people from all over the world. I mentioned growing up in Danville, Virginia. This was predominantly a cotton mill town. Almost everybody there either worked in tobacco or in the cotton mill. But now there is no more cotton mill. All the jobs in textiles have gone abroad. Dan River Mills was the largest cotton mill in the United States, and now it's gone. The buildings are still there, some of them are, but the jobs are gone. Labor has been outsourced because it can be done cheaper in other countries. Not only is labor outsourced, though, but in this economy, and again, this goes back to technology, it is possible for services to be outsourced. If you have a problem with your computer or with your printer or with your cell phone and you call the help center, who are you talking to? India, probably, or someone in some other country. And you may not even know that they're there unless they happen to have an accent. Again, services have been outsourced because it can be done cheaper in other countries. Traditionally, free trade has benefited both the rich and the poor. But now, free trade has caused job losses to both the rich and the poor, as labor and services are being outsourced. And our government is struggling right now to try to come up with ways for creating jobs that cannot be outsourced, such as jobs in construction, rebuilding infrastructure. As a result of this globalization, there has been a growth in poverty and inequality around the world. In the developed nations, as I just alluded to, there have been a loss of jobs, as jobs have been outsourced. But the flip side of that is, in developing nations, people have been exploited. Cheap labor, child labor. Because they'll work for less pay, companies in the United States and other countries will hire jobs to be done by people in other countries for a pittance. The gaps, therefore, the gaps between the haves and the have-nots have grown in every country. In the United States, the gaps between the haves and the have-nots have grown. In developing nations, the gap between the haves and the have-nots continues to grow. That's the downside of globalization. Another downside of globalization is something I alluded to a few moments ago, intolerance. Tension seems to have increased in many of the countries around ethnic, cultural, and religious ideas. The third major change I would like to lift up to your attention this evening is global climate change. Now, I realize there may be some people in this room who don't believe that's a reality. In fact, about half the people in the United States don't believe it's a reality. Research done by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Research found that 48% of Americans believe that climatologists are in disagreement on this. In reality, however, 97% of climatologists agree that the Earth is getting warmer and that human activities are contributing to this warming. It is a problem. We continue to burn fossil fuels as if they were unlimited. In doing so, we heat up the world, literally. We waste precious resources, and we pollute the environment. We seem to have forgotten that the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof, and we're doing a poor job as stewards. We need to remember that the globe is fragile, it's vulnerable, and if we abuse it, there will be prices to pay. We're already seeing some of these prices from global warming. There's water stress already in many countries, and it is predicted that by the year 2020, up to 220 million people will face water shortages as a result of global warming. Because of global warming, there will be crop failures, and people will experience famine. Because of global warming, there will be illness and death from starvation, and also illness and death from many diseases such as malaria, dengue fever, meningitis, and cholera, as the disease vectors are altered as a result of global warming. And again, these bad effects will not be spread equally, but the world's poorest will suffer the most. They will be the ones who cannot relocate to some other place. The fourth massive change, major change, revolutionary change I would like to lift up this evening is that of advances in biomedical sciences and healthcare. It is absolutely astounding to think about the developments that have occurred during our lifetimes in the biomedical sciences. As a result of these, many diseases have been conquered or almost conquered. The quality of life has been improved, and the lifespan of people has been increased. Let me give you some examples. Cancer, for example. The survival rate beyond 10 years for children with pediatric leukemia is now 90%. For men with prostate or testicular cancer, the survival rate is 95%. For women with breast cancer, the survival rate is 82%. So we've made tremendous strides in certain kinds of cancer, but not all types. In the past recent years, the human genome has been mapped, and this offers great hope for the treatment of many diseases. Also, there have been advances in stem cell research, and this offers tremendous hope for the cure of diseases such as Parkinson's and Alzheimer's. There have been wonderful developments in the science of human reproduction, and now more women are able to get pregnant. Couples can choose to prevent pregnancy or to delay pregnancy. Couples are even having babies, as you know, via surrogate mothers. And as I mentioned, the lifespan has been extended. Now it's 75.6 years for men and 80.8 years for women in the United States. And even with that, we rank number 38 among all nations. But again, there is great disparity in the area of healthcare in the United States and worldwide. We rank very low among developed nations in terms of the major indicators of health. We hear the politicians talk about we have the greatest healthcare system in the world. Maybe we do, but not everybody can access it. It's amazing to me how we, as a Judeo-Christian nation, have not attended to the healthcare needs of our own people. I'm reminded of the scripture in Matthew 25, 31 through 46. Inasmuch as you've done it unto one of the least of these, why aren't we doing it? The healthcare legislation that was passed is wonderful, but it doesn't go far enough. And now there's even talk of rolling it back. Okay, these are some of the major changes. There have been others, but these are four changes, and I believe you can see how they're all interconnected. I'd like to change focus now and talk about the implications of these changes for social work practice. The first implication is that we must adopt a global perspective as Christian social workers. We must look beyond our narrow view of the world and have a global perspective and see the interconnectedness of all people. Even if we don't go outside the United States to practice social work, we're going to be serving clients from all parts of the world right here in the United States. We need to realize, however, that our service area is now the entire world. We need to have a passion for all of God's children, wherever they may be. Yes, the fields are white unto harvest, but those are big fields. They go far beyond our shores. We must have a value system in social work that is committed to serving people everywhere. The Millennium Development Goals were adopted by the United Nations in 2000, and these eight goals chart the course for improving life for people by the year 2015. I won't go into all these eight goals now because of lack of time, but the Millennium Goals should be the goals of social workers. Every social worker should be taught in school the Millennium Goals, and that should be part of our value commitments to meet those Millennium Goals. As Christian social workers, this should come naturally for us because we were taught the Great Commission. And we learned early on that as missionaries went abroad to spread the gospel, they also spread material resources. They also took bread and food and clothing to other nations. But now we need, as social workers, to incorporate this global vision as part of our mission. We need to be committed to taking social work into all the world. This means addressing inequality throughout the entire world. I mentioned earlier the widening gap of inequality in developed countries and in developing countries. We must be prepared to address the needs of more diverse client groups, diverse in terms of racial, ethnic, and cultural factors, but also other types of diversity. With these changes that have occurred in the past decades, There are populations that are emerging that we must devote special attention to. I mentioned the lifespan is increasing. There need to be more social workers to serve the elderly, more social workers to serve people with addictions, more social workers to serve people with handicapping conditions, including children and especially returning veterans. More social workers to provide reproductive counseling. More social workers to provide genetic counseling. We need to develop special practice skills to work with these various groups. One client group we must give special attention to is those who have suffered from trauma. Have you stopped to think about the traumas people are experiencing in the world today and the multitudes of people who are victims of war, displacement, ethnic cleansing, genocide, terrorism, sexual abuse, slavery? Do you realize that there are 12 million people in slavery at this time, more than any in the history of the world? And that includes slaves in the United States? We must understand the impact that these kinds of traumas have on people, and we must understand that they include physical, emotional, and spiritual damage, and we must be prepared as social workers to respond to these needs. But beyond just treating the needs of people who have experienced these kinds of traumas, we must try as a profession to address some of the root causes. We must try to address, as best we can, the growing intolerance, bigotry, hatred, and extremism that exists in our society as well as other countries. Intolerance is a problem in so many parts of the world. Intolerance towards people from other cultural and religious backgrounds. It is especially onerous when this intolerance is in the name of religion. To address these kinds of issues, however, we as social workers must be culturally competent in the broadest sense of the word. We are not immune from these attitudes ourselves. I was struck recently by the fact that three major national journalists were fired for making inappropriate comments about minority groups. There were national journalists, one with Reuters, one with CNN, and one with NPR. What was also striking was that each one of them was a member of a minority group. The point I'm making is, none of us is immune. We may think we're not prejudiced. We may think we're culturally sensitive. But we need to examine ourselves very carefully if we're going to become culturally competent and be able to have the right attitudes to work with persons from other parts, from other backgrounds that are different from ours. In order to be able to embrace the oneness of humanity, we must be culturally competent. Another challenge before us is one I alluded to earlier, and that is the challenge of addressing the problems that result from technology. Technology has resulted in the isolation of many people who seem to be glued to their computers and don't have a life. This is a serious problem for many people. It is. We laugh, but it is a serious problem. Even more serious, there have been people that we've read about just recently, whose lives have been damaged by the actions of others on social networks. The bullying, the gay bashing, the intimidation, the taunting, the humiliating. It's even led to suicide of some young people in recent months. Technology is also used to address the prurient tastes of many people. There's probably, I haven't seen any data on this, but there's probably a greater addiction to pornography, including child pornography, now than ever before because it's so readily available on the internet. Technology is also used to facilitate the formation of hate groups. People who have pernicious attitudes towards other groups can collect, share their ideas over the internet. These radical extremists are attracted to and encouraged by the postings of others on the internet. This is a growing problem. And finally, children and young adults are especially vulnerable to sexual predators on the internet. And not only sexual predators, but to their own naivete, as they may engage in sexting, as they call it, or posting images or messages that can haunt them for the rest of their lives. These kinds of problems are problems that we can do something about as social workers, and we should be prepared to do it. The other side of it, though, is that we as social workers can learn to use technology to serve these clients. We find that more and more human service organizations are now using the internet to provide services. Schools must prepare social workers to provide online communication with clients, to moderate online self-help groups, to provide online counseling or telephone services to victims in such areas as sexual assault, self-harm, domestic violence, PTSD, or domestic violence. The technology provides a great resource for us to provide immediate services to people who are experiencing such traumas. Now, to do these things, we must have an expanded ecological model. You know how we've evolved over the years in social work. In the 20s, we had the medical model, which focused on pathology. And then in the 60s, we moved from the medical model and we began to talk more about the systems perspective and to look at the influence of the environment. And then in more recent years, we've moved to the ecological model to look at the relationship between the individual and his or her environment, to look at the relationship between surrounding systems and how these systems can be changed to help the person. But now, in this fast-changing, complex world in which we live, we need to expand this ecological model. Peter Jones, in an article in the Journal of Social Work Education, winter 2010, talked about this, and he said that in this complex world we live in, we must reevaluate the ecological model and make it take on broader dimensions than it has ever had. The final challenge that we face in social work is to the schools of social work. All these things I've been talking about are going to require that schools of social work refine what they've taught in the way of knowledge, skills, and values, and to develop new content in some of these areas to address some of these needs that I've been mentioning. Recently, the American Association of Colleges and Universities found that less than 10% of college graduates are globally prepared. I haven't seen any data on it, but I wonder what percent of the graduates of schools of social work are globally prepared. Now, the Council on Social Work Education has recognized this need, and they've decreed that every school of social work must include international content. I'm glad to see that. Some schools of social work are doing special things to develop international content, international focus. They're doing things like developing study abroad courses. They're doing things such as developing international field placements, things such as providing opportunities for students and faculty to exchange among countries. So schools of social work are making strides in this area, But as we deal with the growing needs of this complex society, all schools of social work should do more. And I would submit to you, Christian schools of social work must do more. Now let's shift gears a little bit. We started out by talking about things that have changed dramatically in recent years. Then we talked about the implications of this for social work practice. I would submit to you, however, that Heraclitus was wrong. There are some other things that do not change. I heard a story recently about a minister, a Baptist minister, and a priest, and an atheist who went fishing. When they got out in the middle of the pond, the Baptist minister said, "I forgot the fishing poles." So he got out of the boat and walked back to the edge, walked back to the boat with the fishing poles. The priest said, "Well, you know what? I forgot the bait." So he got out of the boat, walked back to the shore, got the bait, walked back to the boat, and climbed in. Well, the atheist thought for a moment, and he said, "Well, you know, if you guys can do it, I can too." He got out of the boat, stepped into the water, and sank below the surface. The Baptist minister said to the priest, "Do you think we should have told him where the rocks are?" The moral of the story is, we know some stuff. We have some special knowledge. As Christian social workers, there are some eternal truths we possess. Social work education prepares us for evidence-based practice. Our Christian religion prepares us for faith-based practice. There are many truths that do not change, many truths we cling to as Christians. I would like to hold up five of those tonight that are meaningful to me as they affect our practice. First, the love of God does not change. It is revealed in the Old Testament. It was said in Jeremiah 31:3, "I have loved you with an everlasting love." And certainly the love of God is revealed in the New Testament, where God so loved us that he sent his own Son. We know about this love of God from the testimony of others. We know about this love of God because of its meaning in our own lives. We know that God's love is real and it lasts forever. This is what we need to convey to clients. It doesn't matter how bad their life is. It doesn't matter how hopeless they feel. God's love is there for them. We can convey this in micro practice, working with individual clients, and in macro practice when we go to other countries to try to establish NGOs or social development activities and so on. We can convey the fact that the love of God is ever present for everybody. The second eternal truth is that God's rules never change. From the beginning, God established rules. He told Adam and Eve what they could and couldn't do. They broke the rules, they paid the price. There are rules of the universe today. If you break those rules, you'll pay the price. Galatians 6, 7, and 8 says that we will reap what we sow, and that is so true. Now, I'm just not preaching a sermon on the wages of sin. I'd like that, but I'm not just talking about the wages of sin. I'm talking about the consequences of our actions. I mentioned earlier, global warming. If we destroy the earth, we're paying the price. We need to be honest with clients, whether they're individuals or communities, about the reality of God's rules. There are some things, you do this, this is what's going to happen. You do that, this is what's going to happen. There are realities in God's world. God's rules don't change. The third everlasting truth I would like to hold up to you is that God always gives people the capacity to choose. This is a right that we have as human beings. In the Old Testament, we saw this. Moses made it clear to the Hebrews that they could choose. They could worship God or other gods. They could worship and have life and good or death and evil. In Romans 6:16, we see the discussion of the free will that God has given us. This theme of free will is throughout the Bible, Old Testament and New Testament. God gives us the capacity to choose. Now, this is applicable at the macro level. It's also applicable at the micro level. One thing we can confront the client with, whether a community or whether a group or whether an individual, is that they have a choice. And relatedly, the fourth reality is that new beginnings are always possible. People can always choose to begin anew. The Bible is replete with examples of people who have made new beginnings. I mentioned Moses and the Israelites. Peter denied Jesus 3 times, and he made a new beginning. Paul persecuted the Jews. He made a new beginning. When our clients come to us distraught over what they have done, we can tell them that they can make a new beginning. When communities have been destroyed by tsunamis, by earthquakes, or whatever the natural disaster, we can help them to see that they can make a new beginning. We can help empower them to make a new beginning. The final reality, eternal reality, that I would like to lift up to you is that God's grace is eternal, and that we as social workers are privileged to be able to extend that grace to others. As Christians, we are stewards of the grace that God has bestowed on us. I would like to refer you to one verse that states it well, 1 Peter 4:10. Like good stewards of the manifold grace of God, serve one another with whatever gift each of you has received. We have received many gifts as social workers, and it is up to us to share those gifts with others, to share God's gifts through our abilities that we have as professional social workers. We are called to this profession. God has blessed us. God has showered us with His grace. It's a high calling we have to be able to use our professional skills to bestow this grace on others. We are living during the time greatest change the world has ever known. The challenges I've laid out before you as social workers, particularly as Christian social workers, may seem frightening and overwhelming. But I would say to you that you can have confidence. First, you, as a social worker, possess the professional knowledge, values, and skills to guide you. You, as a Christian, know the eternal truths of God, and these can ground you. And you, as a child of God, have His presence in your life, and He will sustain you. So therefore, my brothers and sisters, go forth and serve in this brave new world with confidence, faith, and hope. Thank you very much.